This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review Books podcast, done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. China's rise to global prominence is a pretty good contender for the most important world development in the past 30 years. But now the question is how Beijing managed to be so successful on the international stage, let alone how large that success actually is, with fierce debates between hawks and doves in the West and elsewhere. Jeremy Garlick tries to offer an explanation of China's success and how Beijing is trying to remake the international system in Advantage China, Agent of Change in an Era of Global Disruption, from Bloomsbury. Jeremy is a professor in the Department of International Diplomatic Studies at the Prague University of Economics and Business and the director of the Jan Marsarek Center for International Studies. His first book, The Impact of China's Belt and Road Initiative from Asia to Europe, was published by Routledge in 2020. His second book, also by Routledge, focused on the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. So, Jeremy, thanks for coming on the show today to talk about Advantage China. First question. Why did you want to write this book? There are obviously a lot of books written about China. There are a lot of books written about China's place in the world, its relationship with other countries. Why did you want to write this book? What's missing in the conversation about China?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of books about China. And, so I had to distinguish this one from those. And I think what drove me to write it, or what motivated me to write it, was what I saw as a lot of kind of misleading, or if not misleading, then sort of biased agendas coming from, let's say, the Western media, or coming from Western sources. You know, a lot of information about, you know, suggestions, implications that China is somehow at a disadvantage because it's not very organized, or it's not very unified, or it's somehow because it's a communist regime, it can't be as efficient as a liberal democratic regime like the US. And these sort of implications I was seeing, not everywhere, but in a lot of the Western media and a lot of some even Western scholarship, motivated me to sort of put this together and say, well, there are advantages that China has that the West doesn't have. You know, there are points that China has in its favor that you're not recognizing or not acknowledging, right? So that's kind of what motivated me to do it. And I can go into the advantages, but maybe let's leave that for the next question.
Well, the title of your book is Advantage China. So what is China's advantage, if only in a relative sense as opposed to an absolute one? What advantages does China have in your view?
Okay, well, this is where it gets, I've got quite a lot of them. I mean, it's not just mm-hmm. one. But of course, when I'm calling it, people might think this is controversial, Advantage China. I'm saying China's going to win. I'm not saying that China's going to win. I want to make that clear, it's like a tennis metaphor. You know, China's got an advantage in certain areas. China's maybe one point ahead. That doesn't mean that the West can't catch up. And part of why I wanted to write the book was to kind of go, appeal to a Western audience or reach a Western audience and say, look, this is what China's doing. These are the advantages China's got. And, you need to look at these advantages and think about what you're going to do about them, how you're going to counter them, and also perhaps what you can even learn from them. So what are the advantages China has? Well, I think, first of all, China is a very large country. Obviously, this is an obvious one that the Chinese often mention and often gets mentioned, 1.4 billion people. That's a large population. That gives you an inherent advantage in terms of economies of scale, as we see, with the China price, with China's manufacturing industry. China's able in a lot of ways to outcompete the West by just by its size of its population and economies of scale. But apart from that, I think there are other advantages. You know, the relative, I use this concept in the book of tightness or looseness in a culture, right? So a loose culture would be, you know, typical Western cultures like the US or Britain would be relatively loose. I mean, people are relatively free and individualistic, and it's kind of more difficult to get people to come together and follow one agenda or follow one course of action. And I argue that, you know, China has often been, you know, assessed as being a more collectivist culture, more Confucian culture. But in any case, whether we take that or not, 90% of the population is Han Chinese. It's a relatively homogeneous population in terms of cultural roots. And it's relatively, I wouldn't say it's, you know, I'm not saying that all Chinese people think the same or they're all absolutely on the same track, but it's relatively easier to unify them, to mobilize them behind a course of action than it is, let's say, in the West. And the other aspect of this is obviously that since China has the Chinese Communist Party as its regime, you know, it doesn't have to contest elections every few years. It doesn't have to have changes of regime. So this gives it the ability to have a much more continuous policy, much more consistent policy over a long period of time. So obviously this also is an advantage that the West, you know, tacitly acknowledges, but doesn't really, you know, come out and say that there's an advantage there. We're at a disadvantage. The West always wants to put forward that, you know, liberal democracy is a better system and everything's better because of that. And the Chinese system must be worse. And I'm saying, no, it has this, you know, whether we like it or not, whether we approve it or not, it has this advantage. It's able to have more continuity. It's able to do much more long-term planning. And I think there's another important advantage I want to mention before moving on, which is that China, you know, has always for a long time portrayed itself as part of the global South, as a developing economy, an emerging economy, rather than being part of the rich global North. Now, that's debatable now whether China still belongs to the global South, at what stage of development it's at. But this discourse about being part of the global South, about being a developing country, gives it the ability to appeal to a lot of countries. I mean, this is one of the main themes of the book. A lot of countries in the global South, a lot of the developing world, let's say Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, even the Middle East, you know, a lot of this economically developing parts of the world, China can come in and say, look, we're on the same page as you. We're going through the same struggles. In addition, we've also been colonized. We also have a colonial past. Many of you have a colonial past. We understand it. We understand how difficult it is to come out from post-colonialism and develop the economy. And, you know, we're on the same page as you. We can help you. We have these resources. We're not like Europe and the West. We're not these former colonial powers who don't really understand your problems. We do. And we can come in and we can have a conversation about what you need. And if you need investment, you need some infrastructure. We understand that because we've gone through the same problems. So I think, you know, China has, it's one of the most important points I want to make, is China has this advantage in getting support from the global South, that it can portray itself as being on the same page, as being a part of a community of the global South, competing against what is perceived in China, but also in a lot of the global South countries, as the exploitative global North. The rich Western countries have been exploiting us, and China, at least, you know, well, maybe it's also trying to exploit us, but at least we're on the same kind of page, we're on the same kind of agenda, and we're not worried about this former colonial baggage, right? So I think there's this sort of whole set of advantages that China has that I try to discuss in the book. And it's kind of like a, you know, the subtitle of the book is Agent of Change in an Era of Global Disruption. So I'm trying to show how there's a set of advantages it has. We live in a very complex, disrupted time, and China is, you know, changing the world as it goes. And this is obtaining advantages in the process.
And so how does the Belt and Road Initiative, or I guess that whole set of infrastructure investments, whatever, this whole program that China's trying to do, how does that initiative fit into your understanding of China's advantages?
Well, yeah, the Belt and Road Initiative is an interesting case here. It's something that came in with Xi Jinping. It's very much his initiative. I mean, he first mentioned it in 2013, about 10 years ago, and it really took off after about 2015, 2016. And what the Belt and Road Initiative, the Belt and Road Initiative is often disputed. You know, people say it's very vague, it's very ambitious, it's not very well organized, it's not very clear what it is. I argue in the book that the Belt and Road Initiative, as it was introduced by Xi Jinping, was a very kind of expansive, broad vision for global connectivity and global development, especially with global South countries, with the developing world. And it was deliberately left vague. I mean, people complain that it's vague, but I think it is deliberately left vague. It's deliberately left vague so it can be like a flexible envelope for a lot of different things that China may want to put in it. And that means, you know, there can be changes of direction within the Belt and Road Initiative. It doesn't have to be a uniform thing that just is one thing. I mean, very often we tend now to understand the Belt and Road Initiative, and it understandably, and it makes sense, as mainly an infrastructure initiative. It's mainly about transport infrastructure, energy infrastructure, connectivity. That's mainly what it's about. And that is a big part of what it's about. And I think that, you know, that is an area where China's had an advantage because China has a surplus of construction companies. It has too many of them. It has overcapacity in construction companies. There's a lot of construction going on in China, but there's not enough to provide work for all these companies. So the Chinese government's looked at it and said, well, we've got a surplus of construction companies. Let's send some of them out in the world and do some, you know, diplomatic work, provide something for all these other countries that haven't got infrastructure, use our companies to benefit those countries, but also to benefit us, right? To give us some, give our companies some work, keep the Chinese economy growing, but at the same time generate good relations with a lot of different countries and to generate, you know, some influence in those countries. So I think an important part of the Belt and Road Initiative is, yeah, this infrastructure, the use of the companies. Also, of course, controversially, the use of Chinese loans, right? We hear a lot of talk about debt trap diplomacy. And I think that is a part, whether there really is, there are debt traps. I mean, there's no doubt that China is lending countries the money to pay for these infrastructure construction by its companies. So there is all of this and this, but I think this has given China an advantage, and how we can see that it's given China an advantage is that the West has started belatedly to react to it. You know, the EU has come in with the Global Gateway Initiative, and the Biden administration has come in with its own set of initiatives as trying to compete with China's infrastructure construction. So, yeah, I think this is one of the big advantages China has. And as I say, you know, aiming at the Global South, aiming at those countries that don't have good infrastructure, saying, you know, we can help you with it and we can develop better relations and so they develop a network of influence through the Global South using this as a tool.
You know, you mentioned briefly some of the ways people talk about the Belt and Road. And it seems like, as someone who also has kept on reading about it in the past few years, descriptions seem to alternate, if not have all these at the same time, as a massive plan by Beijing to remake the world order, or an expensive boondoggle, or, you know, debt trap diplomacy, or now you use the word overcapacity, which is a very popular word amongst some Western officials at the moment. You know, why do you think discussions of what the Belt and Road Initiative is, why do you think it changes so much? And where do you think the truth actually lies?
That's a very good question, because actually, yeah, the discussions are changing. I think the discussions from the Chinese side, the discussions from the other Western side changing. I think, you know, one reason why the discussions have changed is that I think in the early days of it, you know, around 2015, 2016, 2017, that the West didn't really take it seriously. You know, it was seen as being this sort of very, a lot of people mentioned the word vague and overambitious, you know, that it was just too big. What is it? We don't understand what it is. It must be meaningless. It must be just some rhetoric. And I think where the views started changing was when, you know, basically China put its money where its mouth was around 2016, 2017. We saw this huge explosion of funds going out and companies obtaining funds to go out and, you know, implement these projects all around the world, in Africa and in Europe, all around the world. And then there was another change, I think another change again, where 2016, 2017, we see this explosion. And then 2018, the Chinese government realized, well, some of this money is not being spent well. And people in China are starting to complain, why is so much money being spent overseas when we are, you know, we still need development at home here in China? Why is so much money going out? So the Chinese government around about 2018 then changed tack and said, right, we're going to reduce the spending and we're going to focus more on realistic projects, you know, no more purchases of football clubs, right? Like we had here in the Czech Republic, no more purchases of breweries or media companies or something like this that we had here in Prague. So they're trying to rationalize the spending. So I think there was a sort of change there in the discourse where the West didn't take it seriously and then looked and said, oh, well, they are spending money. Oh, there is something happening. And then there was a change on the Chinese side where they said, well, we've got to rationalize the spending. We've got to reduce the spending down and we've got to make these projects more realizable. So there's all, you know, this is one reason why the discussions are changing. And as I already mentioned, I think the discussion changes also because, you know, because of the way the Belt and Road Initiative was presented as this very kind of broad, flexible framework, it allows for changes within it. You know, as time goes by, it's a flexible envelope for shifting policies. It's a pragmatic, large envelope for a lot of different things that can be put inside it, with a lot of activity in a lot of different regions, and, you know, investments in energy and infrastructure and there are other activities that go on inside it. So it is going to keep changing because of the way it's been set up.
So maybe let's kind of talk about what the Belt and Road Initiative is like, kind of, let's say, starting from China's backyard and moving outward. You know, let's talk about Southeast Asia. You kind of note this common description that a lot of countries in the region are kind of hedging between the U.S. and China. And you kind of poke at that a little bit by looking at, you know, there are some countries that are far more tied to China. There are some countries that are probably that are even the countries that are normally seen to be aligned with the U.S. you position as kind of actually being more closer to the center than towards the U.S. end. But kind of how do you kind of understand this narrative that, again, the region is quote unquote hedging between the U.S. and China?
Yeah, there's this perception that the region is hedging. There's been a lot of, you know, writing about this, and the noted American scholar David Shambaugh, sinologist, did an excellent book about these hedging strategies of countries in the region. I think that it's important to know, as you mentioned, and as I mentioned in the book, there is quite a lot of variation across Southeast Asian countries. And interestingly, this is not something I have in the book because it's just recently come out, but there was a survey done recently by somebody by an institute in Singapore, I believe it was, where they surveyed attitudes towards the US and China. And you see an enormous amount of variation across countries, but there are some countries that are, you know, such as Malaysia, Indonesia, Laos, Brunei, which are sort of very overwhelmingly becoming pro-China. It's even been a shift in the last year since they did a survey in 2023 and did one a year later, and quite a shift towards China, you know, in countries like Indonesia or Malaysia. Obviously, other countries, there are countries that are, you know, have disputes in the South China Sea with China, particularly Philippines and Vietnam. Their attitudes are much more pro-US. They're much less inclined to side with China because of the disputes they have. So I would just say there's quite a lot of variation across the region, but there is a pretty decent amount. And in this survey, you know, in 2023, the overall picture was that more people were pro-US than China. And this recent survey, which was conducted in January and February, China has just narrowly overtaken the US. It's not far ahead, but it's gone from being, you know, 10 points behind to being 1 point ahead overall. So, you know, again, advantage China. There's a feeling in the region, I think, that China, you know, China is closer to us. China is perhaps offering us, again, these infrastructure investments, you know, in Indonesia, Malaysia, Laos, countries like this, they're building infrastructure. It's offering us something that the US is not very, you know, clear about or is not very consistent about. And it's more to our benefit to side with China. So I just want to say that, yeah, there's a degree of hedging. I mean, they're hedging their bets. They're trying to keep both options open, you know, waiting to see who's going to win, China or US, or is this just going to carry on being a competition indefinitely? But at the same time, I think there's definitely a movement towards China and sort of shifting away from the US in Southeast Asia.
Well, let's go a bit further away from Southeast Asia, although I guess actually that much further. And let's talk about Central Asia. You know, I think China, at least at the beginning, tried to connect the Belt and Road to this old idea of the Silk Road, these like trading networks through Central Asia. They don't use that image quite as much, or they balance it with other trading networks. But at least in this part of the world, how do you think, you know, your conception of these advantages, how is China trying to use those in Central Asia?
Yeah, Central Asia is a very interesting region because obviously, you know, what we call Central Asia, those are republics that were created after the breakup of the Soviet Union. I mean, these are former Soviet, you know, former members of the Soviet Union that departed from it in 1991 or so and set up as separate countries. So the interesting thing there with Central Asia is that obviously those are countries that had a lot of Russian influence. There are a lot of Russian populations living in those countries. So what China's had to be very careful to do is to try to build its relations in Central Asia, try and get what it needs in Central Asia, more influence, also energy supplies from Central Asia. Also, those as we've said, those Silk Road routes to Europe. Although I think that's a bit, you know, at the current time with the Ukraine crisis and so on, this is a bit, imaginary. I would say it's not really realistic at the moment that we'd have routes going through to Europe much. But the point would be that, you know, China's had to be careful as it builds influence in Central Asia not to alienate Russia, not to be seen by Russia as, you know, treading on its area of influence. And I think China's been very successful in demonstrating to Russia and demonstrating to Central Asian leaders, maybe not the populations. I don't think China is very popular among the populations of those countries necessarily, but among the leaders of those countries, it's been very successful in portraying itself as offering investments, but not wanting to interfere politically, not wanting to tread on, you know, the toes of those leaders or of the Russians, right? Trying to maintain harmonious relations with all those countries, which often tended in the past to have rather antagonistic relations with each other, not to interfere with any of that, not to interfere with the Russian influence, and just to, you know, business only, right? Like we're trying to do economics only. So, China, I think, has, you know, managed that really quite successfully often behind closed doors in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is an organization containing the Central Asian states and Russia and some others. They've managed to, you know, balance those relations. And as I say, you know, what does it want there? Energy, there's gas supplies coming from Turkmenistan, there's oil supplies coming from the region, things like that. Also, the other thing that China wants in Central Asia is Xinjiang province, right? It's right next to Central Asia, the Uyghur population. There are some co-ethnics in neighboring countries such as Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. And China wants to make sure that there's no support for any Uyghur independence in Central Asia. And I think, you know, again, it's been very successful in persuading leaders of those countries to ensure that there can be no support coming from there for Uyghur independence movements and things like that. So all of those things, I think China's been quite successful in managing in quite a complex situation.
So you note that most of the, the largest recipient of Belt and Road money is the Middle East. And so kind of what's happening in the Middle East that makes China so interested in this part of the world? I mean, I think the answer people mostly give is oil, and energy, but why do you think China is interested in the Middle East?
Well, you're certainly right that, you know, China's interested in the oil, and I was going to point that out. That's priority number one. And when we say that China's investing the most, I mean, I'm just checking in the statistics in my book here. It's high, but it's not necessarily the highest levels of investment, but it is on the higher side. There is definitely more investment going there than some of the other regions. So yeah, it's on the high side. I mean, obviously, a lot of it has to do with energy and obtaining oil supplies. I mean, China's energy security is another aspect of China's foreign policy, and the Belt and Road Initiative that we haven't yet mentioned is energy security. Right? Mm-hmm. China is not self-sufficient in oil or natural gas. Right? It became dependent on imports in 1994. That's 30 years ago. 30 years of dependence on foreign imports of oil, particularly, makes China very keenly aware that it needs to build relations with oil supplying countries. So obviously, we have a number of those in the Middle East, clustered around the Persian Gulf, and it's in China's interests to, develop good relations with countries such as Saudi Arabia and Iran, and at the same time to not be seen to be interfering in those countries in the way that some of those countries feel that the America, for example, has interfered in their affairs. And again, it's had to manage things like the Iran-Saudi Arabia rivalry, where obviously Saudi Arabia has been the U.S. ally. Iran has been seen as the U.S. pariah state, pariah state according to the U.S. and according to the West. So China's tried to build relations with both countries without antagonizing either of them, and has been remarkably successful in doing that, I think. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, which has always been a staunch U.S. ally, China is now the biggest importer of Saudi Arabian oil. So, they've clearly managed to build their relations there. At the same time, I think they're also aware that they, as we see with the current problems that are going on, they don't want to be caught up in military conflicts or political conflicts in the Middle East. They want to kind of stay out of that. And that's exactly what we see at the moment, that they are just kind of sitting on the sidelines, maybe doing some diplomatic work in the background. I mean, we don't know, but they're not active, in the foreground of the region at the moment. And so, again, it's all about economics. It's all about the oil. They're also offering, again, the infrastructure investments, things like that. Chinese oil companies going in, offering some benefits to local actors. So all of that, I think, goes into China's interest in the Middle East. Yeah, priority number one is the oil. Yes.
I want to kind of talk a little bit more about China's approach to I'm gonna call them peer economies of maybe not quite as large as China, but getting up there. And I know it's a bit of a grab bag, but your book does discuss South Asia and India, China's relations with that part of the world. It does discuss China's relations with Europe and the broader West. But in those situations, how do you see those advantages coming into play in relations with I guess these kind of larger economies?
If we're talking about South Asia, which we haven't mentioned yet, I mean, obviously,
I know they are very different. Kind of talk about South Asia versus the West, but
I can come to the West. I mean, South Asia has always interested me. These dynamics of China's relations, especially we talk about the subcontinent, we talk about India, Pakistan, and so on. Obviously, India and Pakistan are entrenched rivals, right? So China, again, has to manage that relationship. I mean, the problem of South Asia for China really is India, essentially. I mean, in Pakistan or Bangladesh are much more pro-China than India, obviously. India, with this border disputes in the Himalayas, it's very difficult for India and China to see eye to eye. nevertheless, there's a kind of strange situation where, you know, the India's refusing to participate in the Belt and Road Initiative in the long term. You've got these border disputes, and yet India's there in the BRICS organization, you know, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, the BRICS organization. There's India alongside China, you know. So what's going on? It's I think what's going on with South Asia, with India in particular, is it's a very complex and kind of politically charged relationship, and the Indians really just don't trust the Chinese very much, and I think that's just sort of affecting China's relations with South Asia. I guess coming to the West and coming to let me start with Europe. I mean, if we come to Central and Eastern Europe, where I'm located, which was included in the Belt and Road Initiative, actually, which Central and Eastern European countries were included. They were given their own kind of cooperation mechanism called the 16+1. So Central and Eastern Europe was seen as, I think, by the Chinese as a sort of gateway to Europe, to the EU, to Western Europe. It was supposed to be some kind of a gateway, as we talk about the Silk Road routes going across Central Asia, passing through Russia, coming into Central and Eastern Europe. It's kind of broken down at the moment. I mean, this part is not really working. Some of the countries in Central and Eastern Europe are still quite pro-Chinese, but they are sort of outliers, and they are ones that are not really regarded favorably in Europe. I'm thinking particularly of Hungary and Serbia, right? They're not really regarded as sort of, you know, good members of the European society, let's say. So the central, with regard to Europe, China's relations with Europe are now kind of quite politically charged. There's a lot of umming and aahing and sort of people saying, should we cooperate with China? Should we be competing with China? Should we strategically just see China as a threat, or how should we react to China? There's a lot of kind of vacillation in Europe about China because of the, you know, economic interdependence, where we're very heavily dependent on Chinese goods and on trade with China. A country like Germany is very heavily dependent on its sales to China, and, you know, car sales and things like that. Its economy is very intertwined with China's. How do you decouple? How do you separate that? Or do you even want to? Do you just want to somehow manage it and carry on? It's quite complex. So, yeah, I think, you know, these different parts of the world, we have to, you know, take into account the local context and the sort of context of the long-term relations with China, which may be, you know, different in each case.
So, you know, China's economy looks a bit shakier now than it did maybe even a year ago. You know, the U.S. appears to have gotten some of its economic diplomatic mojo back since a year ago, maybe even a bit, even since, you know, a year or 2 years ago. You know, both of those points can be debated, and they're probably both somewhat overstated in the way people talk about these things. But, you know, I mean, the news continues to, you know, develop even when we finish projects like a book. So, you know, since you finished the book, since you've, you know, completed it, edited it, got it sent to the publisher, as the news continues to develop, as things need to change, how does that affect your understanding of China's advantages?
Yeah, again, an excellent question. And this is one I must admit, I tussled with it while writing the book. You know, I'm sitting there writing a book, Advantage China, and thinking, you know, what if China collapses tomorrow, or something like this? Mm-hmm. So it is something that you think about. Yeah, obviously the situation changes, everything changes, but I think we shouldn't, you know, there was a lot of talk last year, particularly about the Chinese property market seeming to be collapsing and China running into some economic difficulties. I think we shouldn't overstate this. Obviously, China's economy is perhaps not as looking as strong as it did, say, 10 years ago. But we still shouldn't underestimate the Chinese economy. There's still growth in the Chinese economy. The growth is slowing down, but there is, as I argue in the book, there is still growth. We still see growth around 4-5% per GDP per annum. It's not like China has ground to a halt. It's not like China is going backwards. It's not like China's collapsing. I mean, I've argued with people on Facebook about this who seem to be under the impression that China's economy is imminently collapsing, something like that. It's definitely not collapsing. It's definitely still expanding, if at a slower rate, and clearly it's going to slow down more and more. But China is still there with a very large economy. It's still the second largest economy in the world. It's still got a lot of comparative advantages. It's still the world's manufacturing base. Maybe it won't be forever. Maybe the manufacturing will shift somewhere else. Maybe the Chinese themselves will be shifting their manufacturing to other countries with lower wages and more competitive environments for manufacturing. There's all of this to take into account. So, you know, coming to the core question there, China's advantages, does China still have advantage? I think what I'm trying to say is that China has advantages in certain areas, right? I mean, China, the West has advantages in some areas. The West has weaknesses in some areas. China has its advantages in some areas and clearly has some key weaknesses in other areas, right? So I think the one that I'm still like focusing on, you know, fundamentally is this issue of China's influence in the global South. The global South as being a sort of network of partners for China. And I still think China is building up its influence there. As I was mentioned with the survey in Southeast Asia, which really surprised me, it really surprised me how much public opinion had swung in the last year towards China. I really didn't expect that at all. And I think it demonstrates how China does still have advantages when it comes to the rhetoric and not just rhetoric, but also investments and also being just seen to be a partner, while the West is perceived as, in a lot of countries, I think, as inconsistent, as, you know, being, you know, still in a colonial mindset, still not having come to terms with that exploitative past, still not recognizing developing countries as partners and giving them respect, still looking sort of down on them, right, whether consciously or unconsciously, still not giving them respect where China is seen as being more respectful. So I still think there are, especially with China's relations with the global South, it's still, we see the advantages still building up in that area.
So I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Jeremy Garlick, author of Advantage China, Agent of Change in an Era of Global Disruption. Jeremy, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? Not just this book, but all of your work. And what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
Okay, well, nice questions. You can find all of my work. I don't know if people know about this website for academics called academia.edu, academia.edu. You can find all of my stuff on there. Obviously, I can't put copyrighted material on there, material that's still under copyright, but almost all of my stuff is on there. If the, you know, the whole book, I can't put the whole book there, right? But there's a sort of excerpt from the book, so people can go there and look it up and see whether they're interested in it. So it's academia.edu, and you just put my name in the search box and I'll come up there. So all of my work is on there, yeah. What was the other question? Sorry.
What's the next project? What do you think you might work on next?
The next project. Okay. Actually, you might be surprised. I mean, it's a bit of a drastic turn. I'm currently working on a book about evolution in international relations. I did one exploratory paper, and then a scholar in the US discovered it and said, why don't you write a book for Cambridge University Press about evolution in international relations? Groundbreaking book. Nobody's done it. So I thought about it for a while and I thought, okay, why not? Let's give it a go. So it's a bit of a departure from the China stuff. I'll still be doing the China stuff. I'm still involved in, I'm just newly involved, in fact, in a Horizon Europe project where we're trying to build up a network of scholars and network of across Europe of knowledge on China. We're trying to pull together knowledge on China across Europe because we feel that, you know, it's too fragmented. It needs to be unified, brought together in one place, and we need to bring the conversation together. So that's what we're trying to do. And the Horizon Europe project is called European Hub for Contemporary China is the name of it. So we're currently working on that, and it's just in its early stages and building. We're building it up in the next 2 to 3 years.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow them on Twitter at @BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all of your podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Rajrishi Singhal, author of Slip, Stitch, and Stumble, Financial Sector Reforms in India. But before then, Jeremy, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for the conversation.